Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. Today's guest, journalist Jean Guerrero, says, if you want to understand the disaster we're living in today, you have to understand Stephen Miller, one of the most influential White House advisors. In her new book, Hate Monger, Stephen Miller, Donald Trump, and the White Nationalist Agenda, Jean Guerrero takes a deep dive into the life and mind of the 34-year-old. The book is based on more than 100 interviews with Miller's family, friends, adversaries, and government officials. She writes, quote, it's impossible to understand the Trump era with its unparalleled polarization without tracing Miller's journey to the White House. Miller is the architect of Trump's border and immigration policies. He helped craft Trump's attacks on Mexicans and Muslims, drawing from dubious sources such as research bankrolled by eugenicists and white nationalist websites and texts. End quote. Stephen Miller is very, very close to Trump. He also writes a lot of his speeches. In the book, we also learn that Stephen Miller aspires to be a senator one day. Jean Guerrero is an award-winning investigative journalist and author. She covers the border for KPBS in San Diego and has contributed to NPR, PBS, and other outlets. Months before Trump's family separations captured national attention, her reporting on the practice was cited by members of Congress. Her first book, Crux, a cross-border memoir, won a Penn Literary Award. Her new book is called Hate Monger. And Jean Guerrero joins us from San Diego. Hi, Jean. Thank you so much for joining us.
Hey, Rose. It's great to be here.
Well, thank you for writing this book. I learned so many new details about Stephen Miller and his influence on this White House. You've been covering the U.S.-Mexico border for many, many, many years. This is a really personal story for you. Why did you decide to take a deep dive into Stephen Miller's life?
Well, there's two things. I mean, on the one hand, I've always been drawn to stories about outsiders and outcasts, people on the fringes. You know, my first book was about my father who struggled with substance abuse and hallucinations. And as a reporter, I've been drawn to telling the stories of asylum seekers and refugees, right-wing vigilantes. And eventually, you know, that led me to turn to Stephen Miller, who, even though right now he's the most powerful advisor in the White House, for most of his life, he was really an outsider, you know, and he grew up in a progressive city, Santa Monica, California, and from a very young age was expressing very far right views while growing up in that environment. And then when he was working on Capitol Hill, when the Republican Party was kind of moving towards a more moderate direction on immigration, he was really pushing it in the opposite, more extreme right direction. So he's always up until he met Donald Trump, been sort of a fringe figure. And that drew me to him. And the other thing is I was covering the human cost of Stephen Miller's policies from the busiest border crossing in the country, from day one of the Trump administration. And I just kept seeing this discrepancy between what was happening on the ground and what the White House was saying. So they kept saying that, you know, they were the systematic separation of children from their parents was about law and order. It was about, you know, protecting national security and making sure people didn't cross illegally. But I kept interviewing parents who had done everything the legal way, you know, a father from El Salvador who presented himself at the port of entry with his one-year-old baby and was separated from him anyway for 8 months and locked up. And so for me, that raised a question, you know, if these policies are not about law and order, which they clearly are not, given my reporting on the ground, then what are they about? And that's what led me to try to really want to understand Stephen Miller and what was motivating him and to get to the bottom of what, you know, what these policies were really about.
So let's spend a little bit of time talking about his youth, because I have so many notes about how we got to where we are today. I mean, you just reveal so much information, but let's spend a little bit of time. You write that he was indoctrinated at a very early age when his family was going through some financial difficulties. His father is a real estate investor who was described to you as being very Trump-like. So tell us more about that.
Yeah, I really do see Stephen Miller as a case study in radicalization. You know, when he starts to meet these very far right, older conservative mentors who end up shaping his career, he was going through a hard time, as you mentioned. His dad, you know, he was tangled up in all these legal disputes and bankruptcies related to his real estate company, much in the same way as Donald Trump. And you know, I found court documents that describe him as a masterpiece of evasion and manipulation. And, you know, people I spoke with who knew him tell me he was a very combative person, and that Stephen Miller as a young boy was kind of acting out at first to just try to get his father's attention. You know, this is when you see Stephen Miller really start to express his combative and contrarian viewpoints right around the time the family has to move from a very affluent part of town to a slightly less affluent part because of his father's business troubles. And so you see him in Hebrew class, for example, you know, arguing for, you know, saying that it's not immoral to steal grapes from a store. And when the students are trying to debate how to fairly split up a pizza, he just slaps his hand on the pizza, you know, ends the conversation there. But things start to get really heated up when he starts at Santa Monica High School, which is a very diverse public high school in Santa Monica. And he might have attended a private high school, a largely white private high school, if his father hadn't recently gone through, you know, those financial difficulties. And at this high school, he really starts to express his anger, you know, going around telling his Mexican classmates to speak English and to go back to their countries if they can't learn the American way. He starts going into school board meetings to argue passionately against measures to improve racial equity. So not the kind of thing that you usually see in a young, you know, high school kid. And from my reporting for the book Hate Monger, I discovered that, you know, a lot of this coincided with him meeting a man named David Horowitz, who is a former Marxist and a conservative writer who at the time was kind of taking young conservatives under his wing and indoctrinating them in the belief that the United States faced an existential threat and they had to protect America from this existential threat. And the existential threat, according to Horowitz, was the entire political left of the country because of its alliances with Muslims and other people who always, if you're talking about Horowitz, always are people of color. So, you know, Stephen Miller gets it into his head at a very young age that because of his readings of Horowitz, that everything we hold dear in America is because of white men, that white men created, you know, things like equality and freedom, which is ahistorical, obviously, because it ignores the central role that people of color have played in American history, particularly in the civil rights movement. But you know, Miller becomes radicalized at this very young age. He fits the profile of someone who's easily radicalized. You know, he was feeling lost, he was feeling angry, he was feeling displaced. And this is when David Horowitz becomes like a father figure to him, helps him, you know, publish self-promotional articles on his website, you know, fosters his career, gets him his first jobs in Congress, and, you know, eventually plays a direct role in the Trump campaign through Miller, which we can talk about later. But, you know, this is a man who believes that the only important racism in society is racism against white people. And he indoctrinated Stephen Miller in this belief at a very young age. And, you know, through him and other extremist mentors, Stephen Miller learned how to launder the, you know, how to launder white supremacist ideas through the language of heritage and the language of economics and the language of national security in order to make these things palatable to the mainstream.
So David Horowitz becomes one of his mentors. You write that Stephen Miller also grew up on right-wing talk radio. He was listening yes. to Rush Limbaugh, who was broadcast out of the capital of California at the time in Sacramento. And I just want to, in advance, say I apologize if anything that we say or read offends anyone, because there are a lot of offensive lines in your book that come from a lot of these people. You write, for example, Limbaugh railed against multiculturalism, feminazis, anyone who tried to make white men feel guilty. He said, "I'm tired of hearing Christopher Columbus trashed. I don't give a hoot that he gave some Indians a disease that they didn't have immunity against." Do you know if Stephen Miller had any role in Donald Trump's decision to give Rush Limbaugh the Presidential Medal of Freedom at the State of the Union address in February?
You know, I have no doubt about it. I haven't been able to confirm this through my reporting, but when I saw him, you know, when I saw Trump honor Rush Limbaugh in this way, I thought to myself, this has to be Stephen Miller. I mean, just the nature of the act, which was intended to kind of rile up, you know, the left, which is something that Stephen Miller really enjoys doing and is skilled at doing. I very much see that as being something that Stephen Miller encouraged, because, you know, he's been listening to Rush Limbaugh since before Rush Limbaugh became, you know, such a huge voice, because initially he was broadcasting out of California. And this is when Stephen Miller was listening to him as a young boy and, you know, getting the idea that like anyone who complains about anything in life, you know, they just lack self-reliance. Unless you're a white man, then you're allowed to complain about everybody else.
You also write about Stephen Miller growing up in California at a time when anti-immigrant policies were passing. When Miller was a boy, Republican Governor Pete Wilson invoked an, quote, invasion of migrants, blaming them for California's fiscal problems. State leaders pushed narratives of immigrants as subhuman welfare guzzlers. I mean, you have a lot of data in here, a lot of information in here about what happened back then in California, and some people might have forgotten about that.
Exactly. And that's one of the things that drew me to Stephen Miller, because I grew up in Southern California at the same time as Stephen Miller. I'm just a couple years younger than him and grew up a couple hours south of him. And I remember, you know, that, you know, despite how California is now seen as a very blue state and kind of leading the charge against the Trump administration, when Stephen Miller and I were growing up here in Southern California, there was a lot of anti-immigrant hostility, unprecedented. It was sort of ground zero, like a microcosm for what we're seeing nationally today. You know, there were attacks on bilingual education, attacks on affirmative action. Both Democrats and Republicans united around this proposition called Proposition 187, which attacked social services for children for undocumented migrants, which was later ruled unconstitutional. But yeah, there was a lot of rhetoric across the state that blamed immigrants for everything that was going wrong in California at the time. And you really see Stephen Miller, I see him as a product of this environment. And in the book, I try to really paint a picture of what was going on in the state at the time, because I do feel that it played an important role in him sort of internalizing a lot of this, you know, hostility towards people of color. I remember, even, you know, as someone who comes from, my dad is a Mexican immigrant, and my mom is from Puerto Rico, I remember there was a lot of shame, even among Latin American families, with being Mexican. And, you know, people used to hide the fact that they were Mexican because there was so much hostility in the state towards Mexicans at the time. They would say, "Oh, no, I'm Hispanic," or they would brag about European ancestors and, you know, things like that. And so for me, it kind of makes perfect sense. I mean, some people scratch their heads about the fact that Stephen Miller came from, you know, California. But for me, it makes perfect sense given the era in which he was growing up, and also, you know, the fact that he was listening to people like Rush Limbaugh and really, you know, being seduced by this association with white male identity. You see him idolizing, you know, John Wayne. You see him really getting into, you know, people like David Horowitz and the ideas that they're espousing about the centrality of white men in America and society, in American society, and this idea that, you know, too much diversity poses an existential threat to civilization.
And as you say, the conservatives really were at the forefront of this, but Democrats were also. California conservatives blamed Mexicans for crime, congestion, and plunging real estate values. You point out that in the early 90s, Dianne Feinstein told CBS's Face the Nation that, quote, illegal aliens were devouring state services, taking housing, classroom space, and Medicaid. She proposed charging a $1 toll for legal border crossers to pay for more border guards. And then Bill Clinton, who was president at the time, launched Operation Gatekeeper in California, which beefed up border security with things like surveillance cameras, helicopters, and steel barriers.
Exactly. And I think that's very important to remember because, you know, a lot of people have this idea that Trump kind of invented the anti-immigrant crackdown, that people associate the border wall with Trump, even though, you know, the border wall is something that Americans have been building for decades. And, you know, it started with Bill Clinton when he was launching initiatives like Operation Gatekeeper in the 90s. And, you know, I think it's important to remember the bipartisan nature of this anti-immigrant crackdown, because, you know, one of the ways that Stephen Miller has been able to be so effective in rallying voters around Trump is because he's so familiar with the hypocrisies of the left, having grown up in a progressive community. You know, he grew up surrounded by people who espoused common cause with marginalized communities and then worked really hard to protect their privileges by, you know, voting for things like Prop 187. And so he understands that when a lot of obviously not all Democrats, but when some Democratic leaders, you know, express outrage at President Trump's border and immigration policies, that they're really being expressing some hypocrisy, because, you know, just a few years ago they were in favor of these types of policies. And so Stephen Miller is able to weaponize, you know, the selective outrage in favor of Trump. And so until we sort of reckon, you know, collectively in America with the fact that Trump's presidency is the logical outcome of this decades-long bipartisan assault on immigrants and other people of color, then we're not going to be able to, you know, really, you know, it's likely that Trump will win again in November.
Today, we are speaking with Jean Guerrero. She's an investigative reporter out with a new book called Hate Monger, Stephen Miller, Donald Trump, and the White Nationalist Agenda. At the age of 31, with little policy experience, Stephen Miller was put in charge of making policies for the U.S. From day one, he was fixated on keeping black and brown people from the country, mostly asylum seekers and refugees. And Jean says, if you want to understand how we got to where we are today, you really have to understand Stephen Miller, or really where we are today. Jean, let's talk a little bit about his experience at Duke. You write that during his junior year, he secured a column with his college newspapers, The Chronicle. His first piece was called Welcome to Leftist University. He wrote about things like racial paranoia. He argued that racism was a thing of the past. He wrote so many Islamophobia articles. He was part of Duke's Conservative Union, which is where he met the white supremacist Richard Spencer. Mm-hmm. What else can you tell us about his time at Duke? You say that it was actually also when he was at Duke, he began expressing his views on Zionism and condemned the university's Palestine Solidarity Movement.
Yeah. So Stephen Miller, one of the first really political acts that he did at Duke University is he attacked this Palestine Solidarity Movement conference, in you know, working together with his mentor, David Horowitz, who has, you know, repeatedly denied Palestinians a right to a national identity and has tweeted out recently, there is no Palestine. There are no Palestinians. So this very anti-Muslim ideology that he taught Miller and Miller was expressing by attacking this conference, and he David Horowitz recruited him to lead his terrorism awareness project, which was essentially just, you know, a project of conflating Arabs and Muslims with terrorists, and, you know, through websites and campus events. But for me, like, a huge turning point, well, first of all, so Stephen Miller was repeatedly drawn to racial controversies when he was at Duke University. There was a black stripper who accused white Duke lacrosse players of raping her. And it later the charges ended up dropped. But during the investigation, Stephen Miller repeatedly defended the white lacrosse players and said, you know, that they were just being discriminated against because of their white skin color. So, you know, inverting the language of civil rights to attack the same movement, which is something that David Horowitz taught him, you know, calling liberals and people of color racists and oppressive elites, really inverting and deflecting the language. But a huge turning point was when he, as you mentioned, he met, you know, the neo-Nazi Richard Spencer and collaborated with him on bringing to campus this other white supremacist named Peter Brimlow, who had written this book called Alien Nation, which depicts immigration as an existential threat to America. And, you know, Stephen Miller, after that, began, you see him to this day reciting points that are taken straight from this book written by Peter Brimlow when he's at press briefings defending his anti-immigration policies, which largely affect legal immigration. So not people who are breaking the law and trying to sneak across the border, but refugees and asylum seekers, which has been Miller's obsession because he's realized that if he wants to change the demographic flows into this country, he can make a much bigger impact by targeting legal flows. So primarily families who white supremacists fear will reproduce, you know, in the United States and replace white people as a majority. And you know, Stephen Miller would completely disagree with this idea that he's motivated by race or racism. And in the book, I connect the dots between what Miller does and his white supremacist influences, where he's pulling these things from. You know, there's emails that show him, you know, promoting white nationalist and white supremacist literature that I cite in the book. And I also found that he pulled his immigration policies directly from think tanks that were funded by white supremacists who believe in population control for non-white people. So again, it goes back to this idea of demographic replacement that David Horowitz kind of introduced him to. And then when he brought Peter Brimlow, the white nationalist, to Duke University, this is when he really starts to become obsessed with immigration as a way of keeping out brown and black people from this country.
Well, we're going to take a quick break, but I want you to definitely elaborate on the think tanks that you write about, the Center for Immigration Studies, the Federation for American Immigration Reform, and Numbers USA. Miller cultivated connections at these think tanks. Today, we are speaking with investigative journalist Jean Guerrero about her new book, Hate Monger, Stephen Miller, Donald Trump, and the White Nationalist Agenda. Stephen Miller is only 34 years old. He has had very little policy experience, but now he is working right next to Donald Trump. He is creating policies. He is writing speeches. He is emailing David Horowitz and saying, this is coming up. What should we say? Horowitz writes him back and boom, it comes out of Trump's mouth. This is Your Call. We'll be back after this. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. If you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can email yourcall@kalw.org. Gene's new book is Hate Monger, Stephen Miller, Donald Trump, and the White Nationalist Agenda. It's based on more than 100 interviews with Miller's family, friends, adversaries, and government officials. Gene, we like to follow the money on this show, and it was so interesting to learn about who's behind these anti-immigrant think tanks. Again, the Center for Immigration Studies, the Federation for American Immigration Reform, and Numbers USA. As you report, all three think tanks have been bankrolled by Cordelia Scaife May, a bird-loving Pennsylvania heiress to the Mellon banking and industrial riches, who believes that the U.S. is being invaded by foreigners who breed like hamsters and whose family also helped fund the David Horowitz Freedom Center. Can you tell us more about these think tanks?
Yes. So, you know, John Tanton is a eugenicist who is kind of coordinating with Cordelia Scaife May in, not kind of, completely, you know, he was getting her to fund these different movements because they saw eye to eye in this idea that, you know, white people were being replaced in the United States by brown and black people, and that that posed some kind of, you know, that it was going to lead to some kind of apocalypse of Western civilization in the United States. And, you know, John Tanton, he in addition to getting Cordelia Scaife May to fund these groups, he also, through his publisher, he printed the English language translation of this book called The Camp of the Saints, which it's this incredibly racist white supremacist book that depicts the end of the white world after it's destroyed by brown refugees who are described as monsters and beasts and teeming ants toiling for the white man's comfort. So really horrific, dehumanizing language that is intended to get the reader to feel a sense of disgust for brown and black people. And throughout the book, you see explicit endorsements of hatred and violence towards non-white people as a survival mechanism. Because according to the book, again, like, brown and black people pose some kind of existential threat. And this book that John Tanton printed in English in the United States kind of captures, you know, the ideology of him and of Cordelia Scaife May, who are funding these ventures and these think tanks. And you know, eventually Stephen Miller read that book, as I show in the book, and he promoted it in 2015 through the right wing blog Breitbart, showing, you know, that he too ascribes to this ideology. But these think tanks that were funded by John Tanton and Cordelia Scaife May, they essentially work to make white supremacist ideas palatable to the mainstream. They've been extremely effective. I mean, they testify, and they're called in to testify in Congress. Oftentimes journalists will use these think tanks as, you know, to provide alleged balance in stories about immigration. You know, they'll cite an immigration lawyer, and then like a pro-immigration lawyer, and then they'll cite someone from the Federation for American Immigration Reform. So they've really wormed their way into the mainstream. But it's so important to look at the Tree of Life and see who is funding these groups and what they're really after. And you see the Federation for American Immigration Reform, one of these think tanks, issue a blueprint in November of 2016 for the Trump transition team on immigration policy. Stephen Miller took that blueprint and almost verbatim made it into policies. So implemented almost everything that they asked for from within the White House. And this has had broad homeland security consequences across the country, whether or not you care about immigration or whether you care about what happens to immigrants. Stephen Miller is having an impact on your life because, you know, as you said, Rose, he is a public relations flack who had no policy experience prior to being put in charge of policies for the Trump administration. And from day one in the White House, he began to narrow the focus of the Department of Homeland Security, which has this very broad mandate to protect the American people from things you know, everything from terrorism to cyber warfare to, you know, pandemics, into something that was hyper-focused on re-engineering the demographics into this country by cutting off legal flows. So obliterating the U.S. Asylum system, particularly for Central American and Latin American families, slashing refugee admissions to new record lows every year. You know, the systematic separation of children from their parents as a way of trying to scare families from coming here. So, you know, this laser focus and tunnel vision for civil immigration issues because of his demographic goal, demographic replacement goal, according to White House officials that I spoke to for the book, left Americans more vulnerable to a range of real threats, including terrorism and the pandemic that we're seeing today. Because instead of being focused on the distribution of masks and medical equipment, this administration has continued to be focused on the demonization and scapegoating of brown and black people for our problems, you know, suspending green card access in response to the pandemic, to blame immigrants for the job situation, completely shutting down the U.S.-Mexico border, even though there were far more cases in the United States than in Mexico, targeting international students. You know, just these measures that have nothing to do with actually protecting the American people from the public health threat. And this is all Stephen Miller and, you know, Stephen Miller's ideology expressing itself, his extremism expressing itself in the White House in this incredibly powerful position.
I was struck by a quote from James Nelson, who served as Assistant Secretary for International Affairs at the Department of Homeland Security. He says, "I was a government bureaucrat for 34 years. Stephen Miller, is by far the most successful bureaucrat that I've ever experienced. Here's a now 34-year-old guy who grabbed immigration policy by the throat and single-handedly changed it."
Yeah, he repeatedly, you know, bypassed hierarchies and the regular policy making procedure in order to push through his white nationalist agenda. You know, from the very beginning, there's this anecdote that I describe in the book where the Obama's Homeland Security Advisor Lisa Monaco held this disaster exercise for the Trump transition team to help them prepare for a variety of disasters. And one of the ones that she covered was a pandemic. And Stephen Miller's predecessor, Cecilia Munoz, says she was sitting right next to Stephen Miller during this exercise, and he was on his phone the entire time, just kind of pecking away and not paying any attention to what was actually being said. So she turns to him and she asks him, "Hey, is there anything I can help you with?" You know, because she was getting concerned. You know, she wasn't a big fan of the Trump administration, but she wanted them to be able to respond adequately if the American people faced a real threat. And he right away he responded. He said, "Yes." He said, I would like to know, how do I make sure that I'm the person running the show with regard to immigration without the interference of the National Security Council?" So he was essentially asking how he could go about disregarding the input of national security experts. And Cecilia Munoz right away responded, "Well, you know, you need these people at the table in order to keep people actually safe and give the president, you know, good advice." And she says that he just chuckled. And this is how Stephen Miller approached his position throughout his time in the White House, you know, just kind of rolling his eyes at the idea that there are experts who need to be considered and, you know, making phone calls deep, reaching deep into the bowels of the Department of Homeland Security to make his orders and to implement his agenda without the input and perspective of, you know, people who had been there for decades.
Today, we're speaking with investigative journalist Jean Guerrero about her new book, Hate Monger, Stephen Miller, Donald Trump, and the White Nationalist Agenda. Jean Guerrero is an award-winning investigative journalist. She covers the border for KPBS in San Diego. Let's take a couple calls, and then we'll talk about how Stephen Miller got to Washington, D.C. in the first place. Let's go to Ruthann in El Cerrito. Hi, Ruthann. Thanks for holding.
Hi. Thank you very much. I have a question. Basically rhetorical, considering that Stephen Miller, if his policies were in effect when his family emigrated from Eastern Europe, they never would have been admitted to the United States.
Yeah. Well, thank you for that. Before you answer, we have a couple other questions about that. Sure. So let's take a few more and then you can answer those. Let's hear from Robert in Richmond. Hi, Robert. Welcome to the show.
Good morning. You know, his Jewish background is interesting. This is obviously a difficult topic because anyone who dares criticize the concept of his anti-Palestinian views is viewed as being a self-hating Jew, which I am. But I do think that this is exceptionally important in this whole discussion of hate mongering. It's not an aberration. And the fact that this guy is Jewish, has come in here, and as the earlier caller suggests, his own family immigrated. His uncle, who I believe is a rabbi, has effectively disowned him. Mm-hmm. And yet, this is part of what is going on within Judaism, as we have Netanyahu and others who are mistreating the Palestinians. I'm not going to make a comparison with the Nazis, God forbid, but in many ways, reenacting what happened with the Jews in Eastern Europe. So I'd like to hear the author's comment about the personal aspects of this, and I don't believe that Stephen Miller is such an aberration. This hate mongering has been part of our system in the United States from the beginning.
Right, right. Well, thank you, Robert. Jean?
Absolutely. These callers bring up, you know, a really important issue, which is, you know, the fact that Stephen Miller is the descendant of refugees who came to this country fleeing persecution and nationalist agitators in Eastern Europe. And, you know, in the book, I delve into that family history. Stephen Miller's grandmother, Ruth, on his mother's side, she compiled the family history for her grandchildren. You know, in the document, she says that she's compiling it because she wants to make sure that they never forget the value of people who come to this country with nothing but the clothes on their back and, you know, speaking no English. And this is a lesson that Stephen Miller disregarded and in fact, you know, attacked throughout his life. And so it's really interesting to see how his family has reacted, many of them with a lot of criticism for what Stephen Miller is doing. But, you know, he isn't an aberration. You know, David Horowitz, his mentor, is Jewish as well. And he has really been cultivating this far right movement within a minority sector of the Jewish American community, with, you know, with this like strong identification with whiteness and with attacking brown and black people as a threat to America in the same language that, you know, in basically inverting, you know, the language of that has been used historically to describe, you know, the genocide of Jewish people and starting to talk about it as a possible threat, like white genocide being a possible threat. And so really inverting these arguments. And from a very young age, Stephen Miller, you see him writing things like he's not disowning his Jewishness, but he writes things like, I think that American holidays are more important than Jewish holidays because, you know, Jewish people are a minority in the United States. And so I identify primarily as American. So just always kind of, you know, from a very young age, it's sort of like being very obsessed with this idea of national identity and associating it with whiteness. It's just been very interesting to see, you know, how his family's reacted.
Now his parents still support him, right?
Yes. So, you know, I spoke to numerous relatives who say that they can't even talk to Stephen Miller's parents anymore mm-hmm. because Stephen Miller's parents fully support him. You know, with his dad, it's not really surprising because Stephen Miller's dad is, as I report in the book, he starts expressing, he was initially a Democrat, but around the time that his real estate business starts to fall apart, he you know, he starts to become a Republican and to, you know, rail against the quote ridiculous liberal elites and all of their regulations. And so it's not surprising that Stephen Miller's father has been supporting him. But his mother, she's the descendant of Ruth, who is all about, you know, she was a very pro-immigrant woman. And, you know, they donated repeatedly to pro-immigration organizations. And, you know, they were very much about the importance of immigration.
Well, thank you for those questions. And Jean, we only have about 10 minutes left, and I have so much more I want to get to. So let's try to go through these things as quickly as we can. As you write, Stephen Miller is friendly with Jared and Ivanka, and he knew that he needed to kind of get in with them. Does Stephen Miller, you didn't write about this much in the book, but does Stephen Miller have much influence on Israel-Palestine policy?
That is one question that I really wanted to get to the bottom of, and I unfortunately have not been able to confirm that Stephen Miller is directly involved in that part of Trump's policy. But Stephen Miller is Trump's chief advisor, and I would absolutely not be surprised if he was, you know, counseling him on that issue as well. But I have been told, most of my sources tell me that Stephen Miller is very laser focus on the immigration issue. So I don't think that he's the primary, you know, voice on Palestine and Israel with Trump.
Okay. So let's talk a little bit about how he actually got to the White House. Again, David Horowitz, his mentor, Stephen Miller went to Israel on the Birthright trip. This is a 10-day trip that's paid for by the Israeli government and philanthropists for young Jewish adults. It's meant to foster Jewish identity. He was traveling around Europe, as you write, kind of drifting around. In the fall of 2007, Horowitz asked him to help coordinate an Islamofascism awareness week about the, quote, alleged threat of Islam. And then Horowitz ended up helping him get a job with first-term Minnesota Congresswoman Michelle Bachmann. And he, as you write, started writing these hyperbolic press releases. Fast forward from Michelle Bachmann's job there, he ended up getting a job with Senator Jeff Sessions. Jeff Sessions was looking for a press secretary.
Exactly. And that was another job that David Horowitz helped him get. So throughout his career, David Horowitz is really making things happen for Stephen Miller and, you know, making sure that his agenda is pushed through. And when Stephen Miller was working for Jeff Sessions, that's when you see him attacking this historic bipartisan immigration reform bill that was being, you know, it was a compromise between Democrats and Republicans to really further militarize the border, but also provide some to legitimize a portion of the undocumented workforce. And Stephen Miller went to work with Sessions to completely smear that bill and derail the compromise. And they succeeded, you know, by painting any of its supporters as globalist elites looking to decimate America through the limitless importation of cheap labor in the form of mass migration, which was a myth, obviously, that ignored what legitimizing a portion of the workforce would have done, which is, you know, to require a fairer wage for these people. And so, you know, the Stephen Miller, you know, he derails this compromise. And when he sees Trump talking about how Mexicans are rapists and criminals, when he announces his candidacy, Stephen Miller was dreaming already of Trump running for president. He had heard him talking about the United States as something that was turning into the third world. And Stephen Miller was really excited about that. And he emailed a friend, "I really hope this guy runs for president." So when Trump announces his candidacy, Stephen Miller immediately starts to contact the campaign, you know, begging them to let him work for Trump. It provides them a bunch of free labor for a few months and eventually gets hired. And, you know, this is when the transformative relationship starts between Trump and Stephen Miller, who has this incredible work ethic and discipline and obsession that has assisted Trump in his goals.
And as you write, Trump really takes a liking to Stephen Miller because, unlike others who say, you know, you might not want to go that far. That tweet might go a little far. In addition to drafting tweets for Trump, you write that Miller really encourages Trump's most violent and aggressive impulses, and Trump really likes that.
Yes, he is the only advisor who consistently pushes Trump in the harshest direction and never criticizes or second guesses him. And you know, Trump loves that because he has found that whenever he listens to more moderate advice, he ends up getting ridiculed by a portion of his base as weak. And, you know, Stephen Miller and Donald Trump share this idea of what it means to be a man that involves the notion of being a killer. And, you know, Trump has talked about this idea of how it's important to be a killer in society. And Stephen Miller shares his instincts for violence and has his hands on the pulse of Trump's most violent base, like the base, the most aggressive white supremacist base, because he has been reading white supremacist and white nationalist literature for so many years of his life, which is something that is documented and you know, corroborated with emails. But this is part of it. Just they see eye to eye as far as what it means to be a man and to be a leader.
In some ways, Gene, and correct me if I'm wrong, but it seems like on some issues, Stephen Miller is actually to the right of Trump. I mean, a lot of people are saying, is it possible that someone even more relentless could one day run for office? And it seems like, yes, the answer is yes. As you write, Stephen Miller was hellbent on ending DACA, which Trump actually liked that program. Stephen Miller was hellbent on the separation of families. You write that Trump was very uncomfortable with that.
Yes, exactly. I mean, Trump, you know, he's a father. He knows that these family separations look bad. He knows that taking away status for people who were brought here as children looks bad. And he, you know, if Stephen Miller were not at his side, pushing him in the direction of these extremely harsh and inhumane decisions, it's likely that Trump would stick to the middle and possibly have more bipartisan support. But Donald Trump is convinced that he won in 2016 because of Stephen Miller's harshness and his mastery of people who don't, his knowledge of people who don't want any more immigrants here, because they blame immigrants for, you know, America's economic and national security woes. And so he increasingly is leaning on Miller, especially in this time of crisis with the coronavirus, where he's being critiqued for, you know, his failure to respond adequately instead of dialing it back and attacking immigrants a little less. He's actually expanding his scapegoating and demonizing to things like Black Lives Matter. You know, Stephen Miller's mentor, David Horowitz, has repeatedly called Black Lives Matter a Nazi organization and terrorist. And you see Trump adopting this language and really expanding his war on migrants.
And to add to this, Stephen Miller, as you write, is obsessed with MS-13. He is the one that pushes Trump to constantly talk about MS-13. He's also the one that pushed Trump and the White House to bring people whose loved ones were killed by MS-13 members to the State of the Union address. So, I mean, Gene, I really did not know that Trump maybe would not have done these policies if it weren't for Stephen Miller. We have just about a minute or so left. What is Stephen Miller capable of? What else is he capable of if Trump gets reelected?
Well, Stephen Miller is, you know, he wants to shut down legal, and he wants to shut down immigration, period, into this country. And he's already very much succeeded largely in that goal. He at one point said that he'd be happy if never again did a refugee step foot in this country. And I think that if Donald Trump gets reelected in November, we are going to see possibly a complete dismantling of our refugee admissions process. And, you know, the United States, which has historically been perceived as a beacon of hope and refuge across the world, is no longer perceived that way because of the damage that Stephen Miller has done. And I think he would simply go on to dismantle this reputation that the United States has even further, and to re-engineer the demographic flows into this country. One of the things that these white supremacist think tanks pushed for that he hasn't done yet is ending birthright citizenship, which he has talked about and Trump has talked about. So I think that is one thing that, you know, this constitutional right that people have to citizenship if they are born in this country. I think if we see another term, we're going to see that come under attack.
Also, Jean, you write about how the media is still dominated by white men, and that is directly connected to the horrible coverage that we saw before and after the election. In fact, there's a new book out by a New York Times reporter who said, we completely got it wrong. We only focused on white workers. We didn't talk about black workers. Mm-hmm. What is the responsibility, Jean, of the media to really be honest about this? Because I still feel like they're still trying to kind of normalize all of this.
Absolutely. I mean,
and we have about a minute left.
As journalists, we are very careful about using terms like racist, because, you know, to describe people, because we don't know what's in people's hearts. And I think for the most part, that's been good, because neutrality is so necessary for journalistic integrity, which is a key pillar of our democracy. However, I think it's also allowed white supremacists room to operate with impunity within our institutions. And I think that if you have, you know, if you can connect the dots between what people are saying and their white supremacist ideologies, you need to call it what it is. And this is why I decided to call my book Hate Monger. You know, there's strategy papers that Stephen Miller worked on that talk about the political utility of hate and inciting fear towards the other. And so, you know, we need, as journalists, we need to no longer shy away from using true words to describe the powerful.
Well, thank you for writing this book, Jean. We'd love to have you on a future media roundtable, because I fear that the next 3 months are going to be very ugly. Jean Guerrero is author of Hate Monger, Stephen Miller, Donald Trump, and the White Nationalist Agenda. Thank you so much, Jean, for your reporting.
Thank you so much.
And thanks to Leah Cesarine for producing today's show. Thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call.